I refuse to be numbed. I refuse to view this as routine. This is a crime against humanity.
For Black Americans, the shooting death of Ahmaud Arbery and its aftermath add trauma upon trauma.
It's a very sad moment to be alive in this country, and yet we hope we have bounced back.
I'm Shamitha Basu, and today on The Takeaway, from Monday, May 11th, we ask Cornel West for his take on this moment, from COVID-19 to the 2020 presidential race. Plus, a look back at the massive legacy of Little Richard. How his loss and the loss of Andre Harrell and Betty Wright as well this weekend are affecting the music world and you.
It's severely impactful. I even found myself crying about it today, partly because of the loss, you know, of our elders and of people who I've gotten to meet or who've impacted my life so much.
But first, a national check-in on efforts to protect people who are homeless from the coronavirus. The COVID-19 pandemic has forced cities all across the U.S. to try and address homelessness in a more comprehensive way. Some major cities, including Philadelphia, New Orleans, and San Francisco, are putting unsheltered people into hotels to keep them safe from the spread. We recently spoke to San Francisco Mayor London Breed about the challenges involved.
And so this is the age of social distancing. And I think that it's a lot more challenging, not just for San Francisco, but for anyone with a large homeless population. So to expect us to all of a sudden open up every hotel room and have the ability to take care and house this group of people and things would get better is not necessarily realistic.
But the fixes cities are implementing, including moving people who are experiencing homelessness into hotels, are largely temporary. So what happens when the COVID-19 pandemic has passed? Many advocates are hoping the scale of this crisis will force officials to put new policies in place that will make lasting change to keep unsheltered people safe and to reduce homelessness overall. Nan Roman joins us to talk about this. She's the president and CEO of the National Alliance to End Homelessness. And Jared Bray is with us also. He's a freelance reporter in Philadelphia and housing correspondent for the nonprofit news organization Next City. Hey, Nan. Hey, Jared.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Hey.
Jared, can you start by giving us an overview of the scope of COVID-19's effect on people who are experiencing homelessness nationwide? And where are we seeing the most significant impact?
Well, these folks are among the most vulnerable in any event. And so with a public health emergency like the one we're facing now and the possibility of a disease that's so communicable, folks who don't have homes are at some of the greatest risk. The main public directive to avoid spreading this disease is to stay at home. And so for people who don't have homes, that's clearly impossible. And, you know, places like New York have experienced the greatest outbreak. So I think that the folks who are unhoused there are seeing this some of the worst, too. But cities all over are trying to figure out how to deal with housing people who haven't been housed for a long time and are now at a much greater risk of harm.
Nan, there has been some federal relief action to support states and cities who are having efforts to try and offer assistance to people who are currently experiencing homelessness. What kinds of federal action have we seen so far?
Well, there's been considerable investment in helping communities to address homelessness during the pandemic. So Congress provided $4 billion in Emergency Solutions Grant funding, which is a flexible kind of formula funding that goes to everyone in the country, and that is going to provide a lot of assistance. What needs to be done really is twofold: to get people into spaces that conform with the CDC guidance so that they have enough distance between each other and they're quarantined or isolated if they need to be, and then also to address what's going to happen during the economic recovery. And those ESG resources will help with that. There's also other federal money, the Relief Fund, and other programs that could provide assistance to homeless people during the pandemic.
Mm. And when you say $4 billion, I mean, give us a sense of whether that's a large amount of money for this, or is that a drop in the bucket?
Well, we did an estimate, or we actually asked University of Pennsylvania researcher and some colleagues to do an estimate of what it would cost just to reconfigure the shelter system to conform to CDC guidance around these issues. And they estimated it would cost $11.5 billion to do so. So we got $4 billion of that. We still are going to need additional resources, and that isn't really even moving people along into housing. That's really just to reconfigure the current system.
Jared, we've been speaking on this show about how many cities have been moving people who are street homeless to hotels or community centers. Can you give us a sense of how this is working in a few different cities?
Yeah, you know, most cities are, like you mentioned, trying to, at least most cities that I've heard about, are trying to find hotel rooms to individually house homeless people who either have been infected or at least sort of exposed to the virus to a certain degree. There's also sort of questions around how to shelter people in emergency ways that don't involve, you know, sort of congregate shelters. I think that a lot of the typical homeless shelters we think of, people are pretty close together and don't have a lot of personal space, and that's clearly become a problem during the pandemic. In San Francisco and a lot of other cities in California, local governments, county governments, and state government to a certain degree was trying to lease hotel rooms for this purpose. And a couple have talked about sort of permanently acquiring hotels. I know Missoula, Montana recently just purchased a motel downtown that it's going to use for emergency housing for people who've been exposed or infected. And then once the emergency is lifted, hopefully, if the emergency is ever lifted, they're going to plan to redevelop that property as permanent affordable housing. So they're trying to sort of kill two birds with one stone, which is sort of the emergency housing question and the longer term affordable housing shortage, which contributes to the homelessness problem in the first place.
We have been talking to a lot of jurisdictions that are trying to use the hotel and motel strategy. One concern we have is that very few unsheltered people are being brought into shelter. Most of the people that are moving into the hotels and motels seem to be coming out of shelters that are trying to thin out to some degree. We also know that jurisdictions are saying, telling us that they're having a difficult time staffing those hotels and motels. A lot of organizations, sheltering organizations, have lost staff people either because they've become ill or because they're concerned about catching the virus, or they have their children at home because they're not in school, various different reasons. And this is a challenging population that needs support, and it's hard to staff up basically on a dime. But it's a very important strategy, and I think places are starting to get better at it.
And Jared, what about rental assistance? Have any cities made efforts to formalize rental relief, especially for people who are experiencing homelessness right now?
Yeah, quite a few. I know that in Orange County, Florida, that at the very sort of at the beginning of the pandemic, they had opened up a local rental assistance program, and it was so quickly overwhelmed with applicants that they had to shut it down within, you know, just a few hours, basically. Last week in Dallas, the same thing happened. They opened up a rental assistance program locally that people who had lost income because of the pandemic could apply for rental assistance and mortgage assistance. And I think that lasted about 30 hours, and they had about 10 times more applicants than they were able to actually serve. I live in Philadelphia, and they're opening their own PHL rental assistance program this next week, just in a couple of days here. So we're going to see what's going to happen with that. But a lot of cities are using some of the CARES Act money to create rental assistance programs, and then just seeing the demand be much greater than they're ready to meet.
And Nan, what are cities doing to keep people who are living without permanent shelter safe in this moment, besides finding physical shelter for them? Are they doing anything to provide hygiene or anything else that's helpful to them in a moment like this?
Some jurisdictions are really working with people who are unsheltered, largely those in encampments, and not everyone who's unsheltered lives in an encampment. A lot of people really live individually, you know, either in a tent or they move around. But where there are groups of people living outside, there are jurisdictions in California, D.C., and elsewhere where they're providing hygiene materials, porta potties, doing cleanups, and so forth. But really, we need to get these unsheltered people into shelter at a minimum and eventually into housing in order to protect their health. People who are unsheltered are very vulnerable in terms of their health. They're much more disabled and ill than people who are sheltered, much less people who are in homes. So it's really imperative that we deal with unsheltered homeless people and get them in. And I don't think we've made a lot of progress on that, to be honest.
Mm. Jared, can you speak briefly to the crisis of food insecurity in this moment and what efforts have been made to connect people with access to food?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the consequences of having congregate shelters be sort of more dangerous places to be now that there's a public health crisis is that people haven't known what to do in terms of communal cooking and a lot of things like that that used to happen in those kinds of shelters. I know in Cambridge, Massachusetts, the mayor there instituted a program where the city is basically paying restaurants that have had to shut down because of the stay-at-home orders to make meals for some of the local homeless shelters. And they've, you know, mm-hmm. they had a range of restaurants participate in that and are sort of creating meals that can then be passed out in a safe manner to folks who are using the shelters. Some other cities have done similar things.
Nan, are there projections for how many more Americans could become homeless as a result of this pandemic?
I have not seen any projections on how many people are likely to become homeless. I would say first that because of the additional resources, federal resources at least, we do have a chance, I think, if we're strategic, to move a lot of people who are currently homeless into housing. Mm-hmm. But I have a lot of fears about what's going to happen as the country opens up again. Many people now are living under rent forbearance programs. They don't have to pay the rent at the moment. But when all of this ends, they're going to still owe those arrearages. These are many of the same people who haven't been able to work or only work sporadically. They're not going to have 3 months worth of back rent. They don't have assets or they would have been paying the rent already. We also have a lot of eviction moratoriums around the country and in certain kinds of housing that prevent people who can't pay their rent from being evicted, but those will also go away. And so I think we're going to have a lot of people who owe rent and are able to be evicted and are evicted. And I'm concerned that we need to plan better about what's going to happen to them. We, the Alliance, and many other groups have come together to request $100 billion in the next stimulus bill for rental assistance, in great part to prevent replacing the existing group of homeless people with just a new group that comes out of this pandemic.
Mm. And as we're seeing different cities reacting to the needs of unsheltered people during this pandemic, do you believe that any of these temporary solutions give way to long-term solutions?
Yes, I do think so. And I think we have resources to move in that direction. And I think a lot of jurisdictions, California, the District of Columbia, where I live, just took some steps to improve the situation, allowing or requiring that landlords give people time to set up a payment plan for their rent arrearages. I think it's possible that we could come out of this better.
Nan Roman is president and CEO of the National Alliance to End Homelessness, and Jared Bray is a freelance reporter in Philadelphia and housing correspondent for Next City. Thank you both very much for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Wah, bah, ba, loom, bah, blah, bah, bah, toot-a-boo, oh, woo.
The music industry was dealt a serious blow this weekend with the loss of three icons. Little Richard, born Richard Penniman, died of bone cancer on Saturday at the age of 87. The self-described king and queen of rock and roll, Little Richard had a larger-than-life persona and musical chops to match. With hits like Tutti Frutti, Slippin' and Slidin', and Good Golly Miss Molly, he embodied rock and roll and inspired future music legends like the Beatles, David Bowie, Jimi Hendrix, Prince, and Bob Dylan. He was unapologetic about who he was on stage, a black queer man, and he was vocal about the outsized impact he had on an industry that never gave him the credit he deserved. Two other giants in music also died this weekend from non-coronavirus-related causes. Famed music executive Andre Harrell and legendary soul singer Betty Wright, who were 59 and 66 years old, respectively. All in all, an incredibly tough weekend for some legendary Black performers who influenced most of the music you hear today in some way. A clean-up woman is a woman who gets all the lovely girls leave behind. Here to discuss the legacy of these three music legends is Hanif Abdurraqib, a poet, essayist, and cultural critic from Columbus, Ohio, and the author of several books, including Go Ahead in the Rain, Notes to a Tribe Called Quest. Hanif, so glad to have you here with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Let's start with Little Richard. What made him stand out as a performer, as an artist?
Well, I think that if you are lucky enough, or if you have the time to watch his old performances, I would say from about the mid-50s to when he kind of revived his career in the mid to late 60s, you see someone who understood the control they had over an audience. He was, I think, an elite level performer, but also just kind of plainly, I mean, his music was also good. His hooks were catchy. His songs were always building towards some kind of, you know, rapturous swelling that could really capture the ear and hearts of many. He was a great writer, and he had an incredible voice. And, you know, I think between him and Sister Rosetta Tharpe, they kind of ushered in an era of rock and roll that is a blueprint for what we know it as now.
Mm. Were his onstage and offstage personas the same?
Not particularly. And I think that also, that question also depends on the season of life that Little Richard was in. I mean, I think that, and of course, I'm speaking as someone who did not know him at all. But you read stories about how he was sometimes reserved and then sometimes as flamboyant as he was on stage. But I think that he seemed to come alive his most when there was an audience. So I do think that I the more people that were around to kind of watch him or be a party to his personality, the more he tuned into it.
Mm. Who are some of the artists that we might not know about today had it not been for Little Richard?
Well, I mean, I think James Brown and Jimi Hendrix and the Beatles, all these people who started with him, you know, Jimi Hendrix was his guitar player for a while.
Right.
And so there are artists who, you know, I think a thing that I hope does not get lost in the discussing of Little Richard's legacy was that he was so kind and generous to artists who were coming up a bit after him. And I think one thing that hurt him a great deal was that some of those artists, after they surpassed him in popularity, perhaps did not share that same generosity with him. I mean, there's a notorious interview from the 90s in Rolling Stone, I think it was maybe 1993, after Paul McCartney had gotten some Lifetime Achievement Award, and Little Richard was genuinely hurt that McCartney didn't thank him. He thanked all these other originators and all these other people who helped the Beatles. And, you know, Little Richard played a huge hand in helping the Beatles and wasn't thanked. So I think that there's some, it's always seemed to me like there was some sadness there for someone who was very generous to a generation of artists who came in after him when he didn't have to be. You know, at the point he would offer up gigs and offer up opening slots. And I think this is because of how Richard came up. I mean, one of his first performances was because Sister Rosetta Tharpe let him open for her and then paid him money, which inspired him to keep pursuing performance. And so I think he paid that forward with a generation of artists and was not always properly thanked for that.
Mm. What role did his race and his sexuality play in the way that Little Richard was or was not recognized?
His race, and I could speak most clearly to his race. I mean, I think that the removal of Black musicians from the history of American music is, you know, extends far beyond Little Richard, though I think he is one of the most prominent cases of that. I think that he spent a long amount of his career and his life kind of shouting at the powers that be, attempting to remind them of what he'd accomplished. And I don't think he'd have to do that if he were white. I don't think he'd have to do that if he were, say, Elvis. But I think the idea that the public was, quote unquote, not ready for an artist like Richard to be at the height of rock and roll, or Sister Rosetta Tharpe or Big Mama Thornton or any of these people who were ascending to the height of musically, I think we're pushing forward the sound and style of the early era of rock and roll, the blues, of even country music. You know, I think race played a role in them being removed from their own legacies, and it was done so using the idea that America was not ready to praise a Black person as a musical innovator when, you know, the history of American music is the history of Black music. There's no detaching the two.
Let's talk about André Harrell now, another giant in the music industry who died this weekend. He was 59 years old. The cause has been listed as heart failure. And Harrell was responsible for launching the careers of some huge names in hip-hop and R&B. What did his label Uptown Records mean for the industry?
I think that Uptown, aside from André Harrell being the person who first kind of spotted Diddy, what Uptown Records did, I think, was create a style, an aesthetic, and a sound that, for me and my generation, felt like it turned the tide of what was being played both on the radio and what music videos looked like. I remember those early Mary J. Blige music videos and feeling like music was being made specifically for me and for the people I loved, which isn't to say that before this there was no music I loved, but I think that his lens was maybe focused a bit younger and how to get kind of R&B to a younger generation who could see it as something cool, something new, and reshape the style of it, which Uptown was kind of just the next thing in a long line of R&B that was already attempting that and already doing it to some extent, but he really brought it to the world, particularly Mary J. Blige, you know, with Jodeci. There were a lot of moving parts in Uptown Records that felt like they were changing the wave of R&B sound, hip-hop and R&B, but I think especially R&B.
And he didn't just work in the music industry, but he also expanded to film and television and articulated this really big vision for documenting and celebrating Black culture, right? Can you remind us of some of his work in those spaces?
Yeah, I mean, I remember the film Strictly Business, which mm-hmm. came out in 1991. And I particularly, even beyond Strictly Business, I remember New York Undercover, a TV show that ran on Fox for about 40 years, and from 94 to maybe 97, 98. And I think that he was invested, and those are just two that jumped to mind immediately, but I think beyond that, his scope, the line that could be drawn through his music and his film and television work was that he was attempting to broaden a vision of Black life, and he was attempting to do it for Black people, I think, because I think there's a difference between attempting to show the interior nuances of a Black life with hopes that a white audience might accept and warm up to that kind of the quote-unquote idea of a Black person or the idea of a Black person's life. But it seemed to me like André Harrell was really working hard to widen the vision of what Black people could be and could be capable of, and he was doing it for Black folks. Mm.
Another sad loss this weekend on Sunday was the soul singer Betty Wright. She was 66 years old, and the cause was cancer. How would you characterize Betty Wright's influence on the music world?
Well, I mean, I think that Betty Wright was someone who kind of sustained through generations. I think the best, I mean, for me, one of the best Betty Wright albums is the one that came out in 2011, the Betty Wright, the movie with the Roots, or the Roots played on some of it. I think that was maybe one of her most successful albums, chart wise. And, you know, as she, in her final, you know, final 5 to 7 years of her life, she was seamlessly kind of working with rappers, working with more contemporary artists. And this is, you know, decades away from like Clean Up Woman and Babysitter and her hits in the 70s. And so I think the great loss of Betty Wright was that we lost an artist who was seamlessly folding into a new generation of music and allowed herself to refine her voice again and again and again. Mm-hmm. And, you know, her her biggest hits, of course, were in the 70s, but her career spanned, you know, decades. She had really strong albums in every decade, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, 2010s. And she was kind of someone who I thought was really fearless in how she was unafraid to turn corners, unafraid to try new sounds. Also, I think she was a vocalist who was respected and beloved by vocalists. And those are the ones that I think are really special.
I mean, she was also known for her mentorship, right? I mean, much like you mentioned with Little Richard and with André Harrell, in terms of influence of in ushering in new talent, it seems like Wright took a very active role in her mentorship with artists like Joss Stone and Jennifer Lopez. Why was mentorship so important to her?
Well, I mean, I think that there are artists for whom their legacy has to extend beyond just their work on record. She's someone who was sampled a ton. And she is someone who is well-respected in hip-hop. But also I think that she took a real investment in doing what she could to make sure that her style and her influence and her sound lived beyond herself and lived in younger artists as well. I think mentorship is the thing that extends legacy more than almost anything else. Passing down what one knows to someone else is a way to keep their name alive and keep their sound alive. Mm. And I think perhaps Betty Wright was invested in that because of those reasons.
Last week on this show, we talked about how the pandemic has really affected the live music scene and really decimated it right now. But we're also seeing some very creative bright spots, like the Versus Instagram battle between Jill Scott and Erykah Badu over the weekend. And I'm wondering what you make of these kinds of workaround performances and what it means for the performers and what it means for the viewers right now.
Yeah, I mean, I'm often wondering how sustainable this will be whenever, you know, if we're to understand that there are some things in life that will be irreversibly changed, that's understandable. But whenever the day comes that we will be able to gather in groups again outdoors, will this sustain? Because I do think that there's a real excitement around not even necessarily the songs themselves and these song, quote unquote, battles, but the dialogue between the musicians and mm-hmm. the ways that the songs are telling stories back and forth and the way the musicians are kind of... you know, particularly with Jill Scott and Erykah Badu, it seemed like they were just really invested in the language and storytelling that their music was doing.
It and didn't feel like a battle really, at all. It felt like two old friends really enjoying each other's company and commentary.
I think I preferred that. That was much warmer to me and much more mm-hmm. exciting to me. And so I'm interested in the sustainability of this as a model. Is this something that can perhaps be transferred to a live space, like a real life space? Is this something that can be expanded upon in the outdoors in any way? Or is this something that we just get once a month for the rest of, you know, the rest of eternity or twice a month or something like that? You know, I do appreciate the inventiveness of the way musicians have found out how to use their platforms to reach people during this time. But I am also thinking about sustainability and what people have the bandwidth for and how actually eager people will be to be outside among other people. And I think that too has yet to be seen, right? You know, if tomorrow something happened where magically the virus is entirely gone and people could go outside and gather in large groups again, I still think there'd be a lot of tentativeness about that. I still think people might not go to music festivals as eagerly if there were one next week. Mm-hmm. And so I think that these ways that folks have adapted have brought a lot of pleasure to people. And I'm interested in seeing how they could continue to adapt as restrictions loosen and things like that happen.
Hanif Abdurraqib is a poet, essayist, and cultural critic, and the author of several books, including Go Ahead in the Rain, Notes to a Tribe Called Quest. Hanif, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, and enjoy the rest of your day.
And you've been telling us what these artists meant to you at 8778-MY-TAKE.
Hi, it's Elizabeth calling from my garden in Oakland. It was 1970. The Olympic Auditorium in Los Angeles went to see Jerry Lee Lewis with a bunch of other people, Albert King, I Know Country, John the Fish were supposed to play, but they never got to be on stage because when Little Richard was on stage, he invited everybody up to come on the stage and dance and sing, and there were people on top of the piano, and we were screaming and yelling and dancing, and all of a sudden the stage caved in. All you could hear was Little Richard cussing from underneath the stage, and the concert had to stop there because there was no stage.
My mom gave me the best Mother's Day gift I think I can get. She told me the story of when we were in Hollywood Boulevard. I think I was about 5. Little Richard came down in a limousine, and his head was out of the sunroof, and he was yelling and singing and just being, you know, Little Richard. And for some reason, he stopped in front of my family, got out, picked me up, did a little dance, kissed my little infant sister, shook my parents' hand, said, "You got a beautiful family," got back in his car, and drove off. We lost a true legend in rock and roll yesterday, and thank you, Little Richard. Rest in peace.
Little Richard, to me, was a pioneer and a hero, complicated as all heroes are, profane and spiritual, talented and yet conflicted. I hope to keep his memory alive by listening to his music, teaching my daughters about him, and hopefully being inspired by him not to be afraid. This is Kalika. I'm calling from Palm Desert.
Hi, this is Kathy calling from Portland, Oregon. Little Richard, he will live on forever through his music.
Hi, this is John. I'm calling from Vashon Island in Washington State. I thought he was the most dynamic performer that I had ever seen. Still think he was a marvelous person. I have kind of the same opinion that I had of Ali, who was very outspoken and straightforward and expressed himself well. Richard did that, too.
Hi, I'm Karen Kelly from San Jose, California. I'm 64 years old, and I remember being amazed at how the world accepted Little Richard, even though they might not have accepted others like him at the time, meaning his makeup and hair and dress, etc. Music can break down so many barriers.
Hi, calling from Miami, as an African-American artist, the passing of Little Richard and Andre Harrell and now Betty Wright, who is from Florida, Miami also, it's severely impactful. I even found myself crying about it today, partly because of the loss, you know, of our elders and of people who I've gotten to meet or who've impacted my life so much. So my father told me about the history of Little Richard and how he was the architect of rock and roll, and how when he came out dressing this way, speaking this way, behaving this way, it was something people were not accustomed to seeing outside very small sects of our community. And so he was a real trailblazer. And Andre Harrell, genius, thoughtful person, writer, and artist, he brought all of this music into my life that has been some of the most impactful and profoundly wonderful thing as it relates to shaping who I am as an artist and a person.
Now, I know I can't be the only 90s kid who remembers Little Richard giving an unsurprisingly electrifying performance in recording the theme song for the Magic School Bus. His voice took us on that wild ride, rafting down a river of lava and getting baked into a pie. And hey, our phone lines are always open, so you can give us a call anytime at 8778-MY-TAKE.
Surfing on a sound wave, swinging through the stars.
Yeah!
Take a left at your intestine, take your second right past Mars.
On the magic school bus,
navigate a nostril.
I'm on the magic school bus,
make a plane turn two.
Take that, I'm on the magic school bus.
In the month of April alone, more than 20 million people in the United States lost their jobs. And the latest data shows that women, people of color, and low-wage workers were most affected by this crisis. But it's not solely because of COVID-19.
those crises, those economic viruses, were already at work before the coronavirus hit.
That's Cornel West, an American philosopher and longtime racial justice activist. He says this crisis exposes long-standing problems in this country, especially around race and wealth. In this unprecedented moment, we got Cornel West on the line to hear his thoughts on everything from the economic situation to the upcoming presidential elections and the shooting of Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia. And he shows us where those all connect.
Well, it brings tears to my eyes. We are witnessing, very sad decay, decline, and deterioration of the American empire. It's very clear that our commitment to public goods, our commitment to our common life is so weak. We've got individual citizens who are marvelous and magnificent, but our institutions and our structures are so money-driven and so profit-maximizing in its aim that we lose sight of the needs of our citizens. And we see it in healthcare, we see it in government, we see it in business, we see it in education. It's a very sad moment to be alive in this country, and yet we hope we have bounce back. I think that we still have some bounce back left. This is not the decline and fall of the American empire, but certainly is the decay of the American empire. And we'll see how much democratic bounce back we really have. We're going to find out who we are as a people.
I want to talk about Ahmaud Arbery, the unarmed black man who was gunned down in a suburban neighborhood in Brunswick, Georgia. A grand jury was called to investigate, but that was only after very recently when a video was leaked, and the incident happened in February. Is any part of you still shocked that these stories are happening, that we're still here?
Well, I mean, any time an innocent person is gunned down, and in this case, of course, it seems to be a white supremacist crime, so it's an innocent black brother gunned down, I'm affected. I'm not surprised. I mean, the vicious legacy of white supremacy shot through every institution and structure, every nook and cranny of this country. So I'm not surprised in that sense, but I refuse to be numbed. I refuse to view this as routine. It's a crime against humanity. And we've seen this for 400 years in this nation. But the major problem, as you know, my dear sister, is that it's so easy to talk about it and feel bad for a day or two, go through catharsis, and still not be able to intervene and do something about it. And this is what makes me sad, that we see the cycle over and over again of talking about so many manifestations of white supremacist attacks, assaults, crimes against peoples of color, in this case, black brother. And that's just part and parcel of what it means to be in America. America is not a mature society that's concerned about the weak and vulnerable. It's a society that worships money and status and celebrity. And when it has time through philanthropy and charity, it might make some symbolic gestures in regard to this suffering and this misery among poor and working people. But it seems as if we just don't have what it takes. We don't have the cultivated capability to be a full-fledged democratic society concerned about all of our citizens, especially the least of these, especially the weak and the vulnerable.
Well, Dr. West, let me ask you about that repetition that you're talking about, because I feel like when a video like this surfaces, there is a very visceral reaction. It gets shared widely on social media, but I feel like something different seems to be happening this time around, where I feel like I've been seeing more and more people saying this time, please just stop sharing that video. And I wonder how much that has to do with the moment that we're in right now, with a pandemic, with isolation, with trauma. Are we all being re-traumatized and maybe over-traumatized in the sharing of these videos, or do you believe that there is power in sharing them?
No, I think that you can't live in a state of denial. You can't undergo evasion or avoidance of the criminality in our midst. And so it's easy to say, well, let's not look at it. Let's not show it. In the end, maybe let's not talk about it too much. I've got enough on my plate. And yet, the only way you engage an injustice is to confront the injustice and then try to individually and collectively intervene and do something about it such that it doesn't happen again, or it happens much, much, much less so than it ordinarily does. And this is true in terms of, let's look at all the bodies around the hospitals. Most of those bodies disproportionately black and red and brown. But the press really doesn't focus on those bodies in those coffins. They're under the hospitals, on the side of the hospital. In the same way, the press doesn't really keep track of all the bodies coming back from our wars. No, we're not gonna highlight that. That's just too much trauma. We can only take so much. And you say, well, wait a minute now. I just think that we can't be a country that has grown wealthy and grown powerful, and yet we have not grown up. And when you grow up and become a mature nation, just like a mature person, you do not live in a condition of denial and evasion and avoidance. You have to learn how to confront the suffering. You have to learn how to wrestle with the misery and try to come out on the other side. And if we cannot come out on the other side, then we do go down. We do go down as a democratic experiment, as an empire. And sadly so, it looks as if that's where we're headed. We're denying ecological catastrophe that's impending. We're denying nuclear catastrophe that's possible. And, of course, with Brother Bernie, thank God that he's trying to raise the issues of the denial of the economic catastrophe, the wealth inequality, not just the crisis, but the chronic systemic wealth inequality that creates a crisis every day.
Well, I'm glad that you brought up Bernie Sanders, because I'd like us to turn to talk about the presidential race. You were once a Bernie Sanders surrogate for campaign rallies, but when Sanders dropped out, you decided to endorse Joe Biden. I'm curious to hear you talk about Sanders' lasting legacy on the Democratic Party, on their platform for this year. And really, without a push from Sanders, will Joe Biden meet the expectations of the most progressive voters in the party?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, though, because I think endorse might be too strong a word, my dear sister.
Correct me. How do you feel about Joe Biden?
But I'm part of, I consider myself part of an anti-fascist coalition against a gangster in the White House. And the question becomes, how do we get him out before the democratic experiment completely runs out? I consider my dear brother Joe Biden a mediocre, milquetoast neoliberal, responsible for, in many ways, along with Strom Thurmond and others, the largest, most vicious prison system in the modern world. That's what those crime bills going from the 80s and 90s did, and he bragged about it up until a few years ago. I consider his support of the invasion and occupation of Iraq a crime against humanity. You don't just go in and end up killing 500,000 precious human beings in Iraq and not have some kind of reflection and deep apology. It was based on lies, as we know. I consider him supporting Wall Street greed, going all the way back to Glass-Steagall, so that you can see it's hard for me to say I'm endorsing a mediocre, milquetoast neoliberal like Brother Biden. No, I'm calling for us to kind of hold our noses and vote, because he seems to be at this point, even though he's no friend of working people, he's no friend of poor people, he seems to be the only thing we can do to get out the neo-fascist gangster in the White House. That's what it is to be part of an anti-fascist coalition where many in your coalition are not really your friends, but they're your allies, in the same way almost like the United States had to join hands with Soviet Union to push out a gangster named Hitler, right, in World War II. The Soviet Union didn't become our close friends. They became our allies because we had to work together. Neoliberals who are of Brother Biden's ilk, I mean, I love them as human beings because I'm a Christian, But politically, they're not my friends. I have my back up against the wall. That's why I call for a vote for him as opposed to endorsement. We got to tell the truth about him, even as we recognize that he's better than Brother Trump. See, Brother Trump is just dead up, bad news, dangerous, narcissistic, xenophobic, tied to big money, big military, will do anything to project himself and will do irreparable damage to this democratic experiment.
Cornel West, Joe Biden has been accused of sexual assault by a former Senate staffer, Tara Reid. Biden has denied the allegation. What will you, Cornel West, be watching for in Biden's ongoing response to this and in voters' ongoing responses to this?
Well, we've got to give our sister space so that her voice is heard, and we've got to make him accountable based on the evidence. Now, of course, he is innocent before proven guilty, but we've got to follow through and based on the evidence, see where it goes. I don't believe it's shutting her down in any way. And I think that the Me Too movement is part and parcel of the progressive movement. And he has to be accountable and answerable and responsible.
I hear you when you say that your plan is to hold your nose and vote for him. But what do you say to voters, perhaps Bernie Sanders supporters, who are feeling disillusioned by Biden as the Democratic option and are maybe just trying to think of what their other options are?
Well, one, I think that despair and disillusionment ought to be our intimate companions. Given our situation right now, all of us ought to feel a certain kind of disillusionment and a certain kind of despair, but just not allow either one to have the last word. You know, the great Goethe used to say, he or she who's never despaired has never lived. And as a black man in America, 400 years of slavery and Jim Crow 1 and now Jim Crow 2, I've been despairing for the last 50 years, but I don't allow that despair to have the last word. I'm a blues man. So the blues man takes the despair and transfigures it into song, into life, deed, praxis, action. So that especially the young folk, I tell them all the time, I'm feeling disillusioned, Brother West. Good. That means you're not numb. Now, what are you going to do with that disillusionment? Are you going to be debilitated and no longer fight? Are you going to fall out of the political process in such a way that you don't vote in any way? Someone would go with the Green folk. I've got a lot of comrades in the Green Party. I disagree with them this time. I've agreed with them before. Mm-hmm. They're still comrades. We just have a disagreement in terms of how we deal with this particular election. And keep in mind, voting is just one small part of a larger sense of what it means to be a citizen. And you try to create counter voices, countervailing institutions, countervailing cultures against the culture of big money, big military, xenophobia, losing sight of the humanity of Jews and Muslims and Palestinians and Arabs and Mexicans and women and gays and lesbians and precious trans and so forth, so that the creation of a progressive countervailing culture is a larger project. It's not just who you vote for. And so we remain part of that counterculture, even if some of us, like Noam Chomsky and others say, we hold our noses and vote for the milquetoast neoliberal, recognizing that we have to be not just rendering him accountable, but putting tremendous pressure on him because he's still tied to Wall Street. He still is part of the neoliberal wing of the ruling class in the way that Trump is a neo-fascist wing of the ruling class. We want to keep the ruling class itself accountable, and in the end, we want to fundamentally transform capitalist America in such a way that the Almon Asperis and poor whites in Appalachia are addressed. Mm-hmm. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. That's part of the larger project. You see, these are the kinds of issues that Martin Luther King Jr. was concerned about. Militarism, racism in all of its form, poverty in all of its form, and then materialism, and that's a spiritual issue. You see, right now, America has a spiritual crisis. It's tied too much to greed and contempt of weak and vulnerable and indifference to the others who are degraded and corruption. And when you get greed and corruption and contempt all together, you got a lethal combination that leads toward the collapse of your social experiment at the collapse of your empire and the collapse of your democratic experiment. And we're all at the same time. We are an empire. We're a precious democratic experiment within the bowels of that empire. And at the same time, like any social experiment, we can come and we can go.
Dr. Cornel West, let me ask you one last question. With so much inequality and unemployment and hurting and pain right now in the world, what's giving you hope?
Oh, good God. See, hope for me is as much a verb as a virtue, which is to say I'm in motion. Nothing is going to stop me from being in motion until the worms get my body. And nobody can steal my joy. I've got precious memories of Mom and Dad and loved ones and Martin King and Malcolm X and Fannie Lou Hamer and Curtis Mayfield and Aretha Franklin and John Coltrane and Dizzy Gillespie. Those joys can never be taken away. They can send you to jail. They can lie about you. And those joys are the fruits of the love supreme that you have for truth and beauty and goodness and for other people, love of neighbor. That's what it is to be a revolutionary Christian, in my own humble opinion, you see. And so in that sense, whatever the circumstances are, the fight, the spirit of engagement can never be snuffed out. It can never be suffocated. It can never be eliminated. It's a kind of defeatless despair, wrestling with despair, but refuse to ever be defeated. You see, that's what it is to be a blues woman and a blues man, too. And so in that sense, you know, I'm going down with a smile. I'm going down swinging like Ella Fitzgerald and Muhammad Ali with style and a smile and pass it on to your generation, my dear sister.
Dr. Cornel West, I really appreciate you being here to speak with me. He is an American philosopher and racial justice activist. Thank you so much, Dr. West.
Thank you. You stay strong now.
You as well. That's our show for today. As always, thank you for listening. You can call in and share any thoughts about any of these stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also send us a tweet at The Takeaway, and you can tweet at me at Shu Basu. That's SHUBASU. I'm Shumita Basu, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.